Tens of thousands of men and women have left comfortable, privileged lives to join the Islamic State and kill for it. To them, its violence is beautiful and holy, and the caliphate a fulfillment of prophecy and the only place on earth where they can live and die as Muslims. The new book, The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State, is a journey into the minds of the Islamic State's true believers. From the streets of Cairo to the mosques of London, journalist Graham Wood interviews supporters, recruiters, and sympathizers of the group. Graham Wood is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he teaches in the political science department at Yale University. Again, the name of the new book is The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Graham Wood to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Hi, Joe.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. What brought you to want to do this project and to look so deeply into these encounters and to find out more of the people who are attracted to ISIS?
Well, I had lived in the Middle East for a while, and I had watched with everybody else as the Islamic State arose seemingly out of nowhere. And I started to realize that it was a really animating force for a lot of people, specifically about 40 to 45,000 people who've gone over there. And it was more than it seemed at first. These people were, in a few cases, they were just crazy people, bloodthirsty people. But in many, I would say the majority of cases, they had a whole view of the world that I didn't understand and that I wanted to know more about. So over the last few years, what I've been doing is trying to find them, trying to find the people who have gone over there, the people who want to go over there, the people who support the Islamic State, and then ask them, what's going on in your head? What is this thing that you're throwing away your life for? And to my surprise, they've been very willing to speak to me. So that's how I ended up pretty much obsessed in my own way with their project.
Now, obviously, they don't see it as throwing their life away.
Well, they think they're throwing their terrestrial life away and then gaining something much more important. As one of them told me, this life is, it's as if you're taking a long journey, and then at one point you stop for a rest under a tree, and then you get up after your rest and you keep on for the rest of your journey. And the rest under the tree is this life, and the rest of the journey is before and after, in the hereafter and in the time before. And so they think of throwing away this life as just taking a more eventful break under that tree and preparing themselves for a much more wonderful existence in paradise afterward.
When you started on this project, and I'm hoping for this clarification, because we have this question mark with us once again with the attack over the holiday weekend in Istanbul, and that is ISIS actively recruiting people in this case, or are there people that are attracted doing it in the name of ISIS, and why is that an important distinction?
It used to be that ISIS was telling everybody to go over to ISIS territory. So if you were in New York or in London and you were excited about ISIS, they would say, don't attack where you are, just come on over here and help us where we are. Now ISIS has really reversed the tidal flow of its fighters, and they're trying to send people overseas to Europe, to the United States, and to attack in foreign territory, what is to them foreign territory. Now, it's also told believers who are already over here, don't bother trying to come. Attack where you are. Don't even ask our permission. Don't try to coordinate with us. Just do it. So that's what we're seeing with like the Orlando nightclub attack of last year. And then you see a few cases such as the Paris attack of November 2015, where ISIS has actually sent immigrants who are trained, militarily trained in its territory to go fight overseas. So both of those things are happening.
Does that make it harder to get a handle on it and to fully understand it?
Well, it means that we have to understand both elements of the Islamic State, that we have to understand the operational side, the training that they're undertaking in Syria to send off fighters, and also, of course, the internal dynamics of Syria and Iraq. But it also means that we have to understand the inspiration that reaches people without ever having any other kind of connection to the Islamic State when those people are in Germany or the United States or Canada or France. And that second part is what I've spent the bulk of my time trying to figure out. If you're someone who is in the target audience of the Islamic State's propaganda, what are the things that you're hankering for? And what are the things that when you read that propaganda, you realize you have to believe? This turns out to be a whole mental world that people enter into. It is a kind of brainwashing, but I think it's even more intellectually and historically and religiously sophisticated than that. It's a kind of entry point into a whole new world. It's a remarkable thing to see.
This book comes out of a piece that you did for the Atlantic, entitled "The American Leader in the Islamic State." Tell us a little bit about that piece and ultimately what you found out about this American leader.
Yes, so Americans are pretty few in the Islamic State. We're talking about in the low hundreds. And so I, as an American, wanted to find out, especially, you know, what motivates one of my countrymen to go over there. And so I looked to find out who was the most representative or interesting or important leader in the Islamic State of Americans. And to my surprise, I found that he was someone whose last known address in the United States was about 20 minutes away from where I grew up. He is the son of a U.S. Air Force colonel from a very distinguished military family. He converted to Islam as a teenager and has taken a pretty substantial slide toward a kind of crazy jihadism, to the point where now he is in the Islamic State and is one of the, I would say, great minds of the Islamic State's propaganda apparatus. He writes in Arabic and in English, and is sort of the leading producer of English language propaganda and a cleric within the Islamic State.
So how did you get in touch and what were those conversations like?
He's taken a lot of efforts to conceal his identity. So this was a very kind of Holmesian detective story for me. That is told in my book, The Way of the Strangers. It starts off with my having heard his nickname in Arabic from one of his students, a person who, by the way, had never actually met him, but had been influenced by his writing and was in, I would say, almost hourly contact with him digitally in Australia. So I found out that Arabic nickname and went on a hunt all over the internet in forums that were devoted to jihadism, in Arabic, in German, in English, for any sign of who this person might be. And eventually I found, partly due to the guy, this American cleric in the Islamic State, he's a bit of a show-off linguistically. And one of the names that he gave to himself in Arabic turned out to be a translation from Greek into Arabic of the names of his ancestors. So the Arabic names traditionally will give so-and-so the father of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, and give the lineage like that. Well, there are Greek and Greek-influenced names that all of his ancestors have had, and he translated them directly into Arabic. And so when I found a name, and it looked a little bit off in the Arabic, by translating it back into Greek, I found out what his real name was, and in the end was able to find out his home address and the home address of his parents.
He converted to Islam as a 17-year-old, and I'm curious about that aspect of the story because This does resonate very much so with young people, doesn't it?
Yeah, in many ways it's a young person's game, both because of the violence and also just a sense of rebellion that people have when they decide to go to the Islamic State. You mentioned he was 17. He had left home. He had gone off to community college in College Station, Texas. And at some point he decided, I think this is my psychologizing him, of course, that he would never succeed in the military path that his father and grandfather had distinguished themselves in. Instead, he needed to find another way, and something ideally that would decisively reject what his family and the authority figures in his life stood for. So he went to the mosque and became Muslim and then found his true calling, which was not Islam per se, but a particular jihadist interpretation of Islam that is extremely aggressively intolerant toward other Muslims and certainly toward his Greek Orthodox family. It's a journey that I mean, it's like a season of Homeland all in itself, to be
right.
quite honest, to find out how a kid who's a mild-mannered computer programmer at the age of 17 ends up as a jihadist cleric in Raqqa, Syria.
Now, he marries a British Muslim extremist, and you write that they bond over jihad and getting high. So,
yeah, that's right.
But they're both significant, aren't they?
They are. It's first of all part and parcel with the rebelliousness. If you're from a family where, you know, the dad's getting drug tested because it's part of his work, then to get really into drugs is one way to rebel. And of course, because he's a Muslim, it is generally frowned upon within Islam to use drugs at all. But also because he's a kind of brainiac, he looked into early Islamic scripture and text and history, and he actually produced a kind of learned essay on the history of cannabis in Islam, arguing against 1,400 years of interpretation that cannabis should actually be permitted. This is not a position that's been taken up by most jihadists, but I think hemp was really important to this guy. Even before he was jihadist, when he had recently converted, and I don't know what he actually does for chemical entertainment now that he's in the Islamic State.
What is his? And you read about this, and so what do we know of his current status within ISIS, and his power within what organization exists in that group?
Yeah, so when someone goes over to the Islamic State, they go into a kind of black hole. Information goes in, and it does not come out, except in very regulated dribs and drabs. So for most people, when they go over there, you don't hear anything at all, except for a few messages they might send back to family. In the case of this guy, his name is John Georgeless, it's a bit different. He has taken a leadership role and has been the author of major propaganda pieces. So ISIS has propaganda channels that put out HD videos, glossy magazines. And for the English language stuff, his fingerprints are all over it. So we know that he is the author of a great deal of English language propaganda. The most tantalizing thing, though, to me, is that his name in Arabic is Abu Hassan al-Muhajir, which it's not that uncommon a name, but what's most curious is that a name almost identical to it is shared by the new official spokesman of the Islamic State. It's off by one letter, and these names are ones that he tries on like new clothes and discards now and then. So it's not impossible that this might be the same person, in which case this is an extraordinary development. The top propagandist of the Islamic State may be a kid from Plano, Texas.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense of, with all that has been talked about over the last year during our presidential campaign, as to how to get a handle on the problem of ISIS, obviously a world problem, I'm most interested in what you think that we are doing that is positive and is correct?
I think the main thing that we've done well over the last couple years is not having fallen into one of the Islamic State's traps, which is they desperately wanted the fight in Iraq and Syria to be a fight of Americans against Muslims. And to an extent, it has been that fight. That is, the American Air Force has been the air force of the Kurds, of the Iraqis against ISIS. But it's not really taken on that look from the perspective of their propaganda or from the battlefield. That is, it's mostly Iraqi and Kurdish Muslims who have been fighting ISIS, and we've done well to keep it looking that way. What we have not done so well, though, is confronting the fact that even when we retake the battlefield and the main cities, Mosul and Raqqa, from the Islamic State, we still don't really know what to do with the fact that this again, is a whole utopian vision of the world. It's an idea of paradise. It's an idea of how societies should be reformed and changed and governed that exists in the hearts and minds of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. And that will be the case for a long time. They live, as I say, not entirely in the Islamic State, but in large numbers in Western Europe, in numbers even in our own country. So to have a full appreciation of the problem, we really have to start understanding what's going through people's heads and then figure out how we can take part in that mental battle as well as the physical one.
Graham Wood is our guest. The name of the book is The Way of Strangers: Encounters with the Islamic State. So piggybacked on that question of, is there such a thing given the sort of scattered approach to the group as a whole, how do we know if we are being successful?
Well, we have to temper our hopes here. Success in an ideas battleground does not happen suddenly. It happens when we start noticing, I think, that people are not as excited by the ideas as they once were. It's a slow trend that changes. It's like a change of style in clothing or in music, where right now the hottest new thing is still the Islamic State. If you are a young Muslim who is looking for a way to do something that's cool, that's of your generation, that might get you some cred among your peers, you go to the Islamic State. We might see, and this is the sign of success, that soon if you're a 19-year-old kid and you go off to the Islamic State and you write on Facebook, hey, I'm over here in Syria, that your friends will shake their heads. They'll view it as tragic. Ideally, they'll even view it as laughable. That is to say, this person must be a complete idiot. That change is slowly happening, but we have to be ready for it to take years for it to be firmly felt.
When you went on this exploration, that idea of the way of the strangers, talk a little bit about that, of that concept and what it ultimately means and what it meant to you in rounding these people up.
You know, when I started talking to people, they would often be surprisingly open about how small a minority within the religion of Islam they represented. They would say, you know, most people who call themselves Muslims, they're not really Muslims. They're apostates. And as such, they should be killed. And so I came to wonder, you know, don't you feel like the fact that your numbers are so small reveals how wrong you might be? Your minority status is not a good sign for you, is it? I asked them. And they said to me, a very interesting reply, they quoted a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, which is, Islam began as something strange, and it will return to being something strange. So blessed be the strangers. And they said, we are the strangers. We know that we are weird. We know that we're outsiders to the faith. But that, for us, is a sign of our righteousness. It means we're on the right path, not the wrong one. And so weirdness is something we welcome. And when you point this out to us, we nod our heads and we say, yes, that's a sign we're on the right path and that people should be following us. God told us from the beginning that we'd be in an embattled minority, and it's a status that we cherish. I later found out that almost everyone I spoke to had at some point been part of a group, either a terrorist group or a social group, or even in one case, a trivia team called the Strangers, Al-Ghuraba in Arabic. So it's a metaphor that they, or a slogan that they very readily adopted for themselves.
How strong is the religious aspect?
In my view, it's very strong. It's sometimes difficult to untangle because it's complicated.
Right.
As I say, the religion for them, it's very important. It is also very different from the other types of Islam and even other types of jihadism. So you'll often hear Muslims say, oh, Islam has nothing to do with it. I think what they really mean when they're being honest is that Islam as a religion rejects the majority of Muslims reject what they're doing. But everyone I spoke to was quite serious about religion and was definitely motivated by it. They had a brutal, intolerant view of their religion, a minority view of their religion, but it was something they thought about constantly. And if you subtracted that from their mental picture of the world, it would have made no sense. They would certainly not have been interested in going off to Syria. But with that part of the picture intact, it was really all they were doing. They were shaping their lives around it. So I think religion is incredibly important for all of them.
What do you hope that reading this story lets people know, and what baseline knowledge it gives us for the stories that will come in the days and weeks and months to come?
Well, when I read the news, I often see the newest attack from the Islamic State. Most recently, someone walking into a nightclub and killing almost 50 people, shooting them point-blank range. And I have the same reaction that most people have, which is, this is an incomprehensible crime. It makes me shudder just to contemplate it. But I'm hoping that by reading my book, people will have a sense beyond the confusion. They'll have a sense of what that person might have been like who perpetrated this atrocity. And then also what the tens of thousands of people who support that person might be like. They are evil, to be sure, but we have to be able to understand them. We have to be able to know who they are, where they come from. And from that, I think people will be less worried about the threat that they pose, but also more because it's not pervasive. It's not something that lurks behind every corner. But I think they'll be able to understand the world a bit better and understand this aspect of the foreign policy of our country.
Graham Wood is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, and he teaches in the political science department at Yale University. The name of the new book is The Way of the Strangers, Encounters with the Islamic State. It is published by Random House. Sir, I thank you very much for being with us and for sharing your knowledge. I greatly appreciate it, and a very happy new year to you.
To you, too. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the new book, The Way of the Strangers by Graham Wood, published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.